Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J. This morning is former Chicago Tribune columnist John Cass, johncass.com. He'll be with us momentarily, just getting in the right headspace so he can do the floor exercise, right? So we're happy to have John Cass back performing. I skipped town this weekend for Lollapalooza. I missed the festivities. So do tell what transpired. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. I know there was some controversy. Not about 100,000 people a day not wearing masks against the backdrop of all of the chastising about mask wearing and the Delta variant and so on and so forth. We'll get to all the COVID stuff. But DaBaby, John Cass, one of John Cass's favorite artists, DaBaby, was pulled from the lineup, didn't get his stage time. John Cass joins us now, John.
Good morning.
Good morning. DaBaby.
My favorite artist.
I know. He got pulled. The only person I think who likes that duet he did with Dua Lipa, Levitating, than you is Justin, who will be playing it at his wedding. Yeah. DaBaby pulled for making homophobic comments because, as you know, John, Lollapalooza is all about inclusion, was founded on diversity, inclusivity, respect, and love. That was a statement from Lollapalooza, I guess from Perry Farrell.
Well, the after party must have been great.
By the way, did you see the picture of Perry Farrell, who's, for those of you not down with it, Perry Farrell is the creator of Lollapalooza, former frontman for Jane's Addiction, his wife and Lori Lightfoot? The three of them together.
Did Lori officiate at their second or third wedding like she did the Kennedys?
No, but that was the only picture I saw of three people that was more disturbing than Perry Farrell's wife. And the embalming fluid is doing wonders for Perry Farrell at 62 years of age. Wow. Whew. I tweeted it out if you want to check it out at Dan Proft. But anyway, back to DaBaby. He made some profane remarks about gay people. He also uses the N-word religiously at some other event, and this came to light, and so he was pulled from the lineup. Now, I think that you need to at least have Lil Baby and Baby weigh in before you pull DaBaby from the lineup.
I didn't know there was a Lil Baby.
I mean, I think that's only fair.
Sorry,
I mean,
do they play with Merle Haggard?
They're sort of a different genre, different century. But other than that, Michael on the South Side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning, Dan. Morning, John.
Morning.
Hope you both are well. I had to take the red line south from downtown on Saturday afternoon, and it was an absolute disaster. The people were packed in like sardines, and there were tons of Lollapalooza fans not wearing any masks. I would not be surprised.
Yeah, what's with that?
Well, there was no mask mandate. Yeah. You know, the good doctor Lightfoot and the good doctor Arwardi both said, hey, look, we're going to take the precautions necessary to make sure that everyone is safe. And so we had the reporting from the dutiful Chicago Press Corps that 90% of those entering presented a vaccination card with the name McLovin on it. And then the other 8% tested negative. They had a negative COVID test, and then the other 2% are super spreaders. So everything's fine.
So, Michael, the city gets its revenue. Lightfoot gets her party, and then now we can mask, right? Now that it's over, everyone can slap the face diapers on?
Oh, sure. That's great for the rest of us, but seriously, Mayor Lightfoot was chasing the Chicago Police Department after people going to church a year ago. She had so-called ambassadors patrolling the lakefront to remind people to mask up, and now she's going to let these jokers, you know, pack the red line and not wearing any masks. Total joke.
Thanks for the call, Michael. Total joke. Well, that's sort of the city of Chicago's calling card.
They're going to rename the city after that.
By the way, with respect to those vaccination cards, it was pretty interesting. I mean, I made the joke
about... What was the fake name?
What was what?
You said there was like a fake name. Everyone had the same name.
McLovin from Superbad.
Oh, see?
You don't get any of my references. You're still thinking about Merle Haggard.
That's why I come on the show with you.
To get culturally literate.
My pop culture.
There was also some of the vaccination cards also had D's Nuts. That was the name on the vaccination cards. D's Nuts. Who is, I believe, a presidential candidate. Lollapalooza COVID rules. FBI warns against using fake documents to get into Chicago Music Festival. Oh, really? Well, the FBI is on. Nothing gets by the FBI. Yeah. Really?
Cracker Jacks.
Yeah, a bunch of teenagers and young adults that don't work are going to use fake vax cards? Really?
But could you use your stimulus money, COVID stimulus money, to buy a Lollapalooza four-day extravaganza?
VIP. Absolutely.
Right.
A related story, since we're talking about Chicago, President Obama is throwing a party for himself, of course. He's turning 60, and he's going to host 500 guests at the compound in Martha's Vineyard, I'm sure.
Have you seen the pictures of that thing?
Oh, yeah. Well, you got to have space for Valerie Jarrett, your buddy. She's, I assume, the party planner. Arnie Duncan, I'm sure, will be one of the servers. And the question about, will they be wearing masks at this gala affair? 500 people.
I want to see.
Yeah.
You know, let's go.
Our
me
betters.
And you.
I don't know, we're on the invite list. The Chris Kennedy, officiating the Chris Kennedy wedding.
That was
Chris Kennedy's kid.
Yeah.
Chris Kennedy and Chris Kennedy's kid, who's, I guess, also named, I don't know what his name is. Yeah, Chris Kennedy and Aaron.
His name's Kennedy.
Aaron Daigle, right.
That's
all you really
That's
need
all
to know.
That matters.
Yeah, she officiated over their wedding. That's
how does she
marriage made to last?
You're a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
You went to law school. How does you're the mayor of Chicago? Are you? Is that like the captain on the love boat? You could go anywhere, get people marry people. How does that work?
I don't know. Maybe she's some sort of high priestess of some some faction of the occult like the Kennedys.
Right.
I mean, isn't this what drew them together? The selling of their soul to the netherworld?
I say three times you were married, and she throws three, puffs of smoke. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like it would be like Job from Arrested Development officiating a wedding. A lot of magic.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
Let's go. Left foot, right foot, levitate. Pop stars.
There it is. John Cass's favorite artist, DaBaby, who you'll have to renounce now lest you be lumped in with his homophobic comments. Yeah.
DaBaby, I'm with you, man. But I'm not, I don't know what you said.
You wouldn't approve of it.
I don't defend until death your right to say it, but I just love the name DaBaby.
No, I know. You are like Dua Lipa. You're like, that's not DaBaby I know. No. That's not my DaBaby. Chicago, we've gone from DaBears to DaBaby.
Perfect.
Yeah, real progress. Speaking of Chicago, 44-8. 44 shot, 8 murdered over the weekend.
City of Anarchy.
In New York, it's not just identitarian mayors or the identitarian mayor, the non-prosecution prosecutor here, as we've talked about extensively. 10 people shot in a targeted attack by gang members who fled on mopeds. Apparently, New York City has turned into Naples, Italy.
Mopeds or Vespas?
Did you ever see the Vespa gang? Did you ever see the show Gomorrah?
No.
No, you got to watch Gomorrah. It's really good.
On what platform?
I think you get the first couple seasons on one of the streams, Obama streaming service. What's it called? Netflix?
Yeah.
Maybe Amazon too. But it's about
That's where I go for my rom coms and think of Michelle and Obama.
Sure, right. Well, after you're done with Hope Floats,
Spagia.
Yeah. Well, but with respect to this, so it's about crime families in Naples, Italy, and most of the street level guys.
Gomorrah. Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
My barber's from Naples, so he endorses the show.
Oh,
it's Rafael Rea.
It's an awesome show. It's really good show.
Sicily.
It's less enjoyable to live it out in reality in New York City, apparently. But what about, a quick comment. I don't know if there's anything more to say. I mean, the important thing is she had fun. I'm talking about Triple Threat. She had fun with Perry Farrell and his wife. She had fun with the Kennedys at some compound here officiating their wedding.
Your city's falling apart. Chicago is plunging into anarchy fiscally, politically, and obviously crime-wise. And you go to hang out with the Kennedys for a photo op and become play minister or love boat. Why, who I blame for all this, everybody? Dan Proft.
Really?
Yeah. One, you encouraged her on the Triple Threat thing. And two, you never grabbed me by the scruff of the neck and slapped me in the mouth and said, "What the hell are you doing?
Oh!
Why didn't you do anything?"
A John Cass recantation on Triple Threat?
Come on. All those of you who read johncassnews.com know that I've recanted.
Yeah.
Recanting's not the right word.
No, but you've evolved in your thinking.
Oh, that's what the lefties do, right?
Is that what you've
I've
done?
Evolved from salamander to a lizard with scales.
Did you have a period of reflection and counseling where you came to terms with your erroneous characterizations of Lightfoot? I mean, your false hopes.
It was false hopes. It wasn't erroneous characterizations. I think it was after the second or third wave of looting that she allowed, with the downtown being destroyed, that I kind of started thinking she was just like a caricature. Of a politician, like dancing on a log, trying not to get wet.
Maybe we need to bring the Grifters back, but unfortunately...
You mean the musical band?
No, I mean...
I love them.
I mean, like the collection of miniature Irish politicians, and also the guy from the Balkans, Fast Eddie, but he's not going to be able to come back because he just got sentenced again to 18 months in prison.
How old is he now?
He's in his 70s. I don't know. We'll have to take a look. But I want to talk about that because... of the characterization of Edward Doleac by so many people. I've never met him, but so many people I know on the center right, and I know you know him.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
Think of a wolf. Think of a wolf that you could pet.
Okay.
The wolf comes up to you.
You pet him right before he rips off your arm.
And you know in the back of your mind, any second, it'll happen. Maybe just your hand.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J. This morning is John Cass, johncassnews.com, and Chicago Way Podcast as well.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So maybe, this would be fun if you had like Verdoliak, Madigan, and Burke all sharing a cell or sharing a room like...
Who slices the garlic thin so that it liquefies in the pan?
Yeah, it'd be like Goodfellas. Yeah. Yeah. Good.
Who slices the apples into 16 little pieces?
It's not the Irish guy who's... The two Irish guys who are going to cook. Somebody's got to cook.
They're going to make the porridge on the hot plate.
So, Fast Eddie Verdoliak sentenced again, 18-month sentence Friday for income tax evasion. To be convicted twice for really three different sets of crimes is most unusual, says UIC poli-sci professor Dick Simpson. Oh, the unusual is usual here, especially with our politicians. So, losing all
Dick
of these.
Dick used to hang out with them at the city council.
Well, he was a former alderman. Yeah,
former alderman.
Well, I mean, losing all these panjan drums, these gentlemen who've devoted their lives to public service the way Madigan Burke and Verdoliak have. Boy, I don't know.
I think they spell it cervix, not cervix.
How are we going to fill this void? So here's what I tweeted, and the responses are interesting, sort of proving my point. Thank you for those who did. I tweeted out, I've never met him, but I was always intrigued by friends of a center-right persuasion who describe him as a nice guy.
Yeah, I saw that, and I think I retweeted it.
Like a good fella. He's a good fella. So here, he's a hail fellow well-met who had no compunction about fleecing his neighbors. And I said, Chicago, this is where the blind leads the willfully blind.
In the city of tribes, Verdoliak was a tribal leader. And so he had all his guys, all the people that he cared about that were part of his crew and clique and his neighborhood in the 10th Ward in South Chicago. So many different characters. Hawk, One-Eyed Hawk, Tony Roque, the Ox.
One-Eyed Hawk from Game of Thrones?
He was a Cook County Sheriff's deputy who apparently, I think allegedly, allowed a street gang member to have conjugal relations in the judge's chambers. But that's Chicago, you know.
Right, that generates a shoulder shrug.
Hey, you know.
So the thing that you described, though, like he has his guys and Madigan has his guys and Burke has his guys. And then
that's what it is.
The Cook County judges are all, they're all belong to all three of them.
All right, so I'm at a party at Verdoliak's house when I was working for the Daily Calumet. And he had a big barbecue every year, and I had to cover it. And while I was covering it, I was trying to put him in jail on a scrap contract, okay? And I didn't know that the U.S. attorney helped negotiate the contract before he became U.S. attorney. So I show up, and he's like, hey, do you want a beer, kid? And I'm like, yeah, sure, I'll have a beer. And he points to the bartenders. There's three bartenders, middle-aged guys with white shirts, you know, with the notches in the shirts.
Right. And, like that's something out of, like, All in the Family. Yeah.
And he says, hey, get the kid a beer. Make sure it's cold. Okay, judge? He had judges. There were judges sticking their hands in ice buckets to get beer. Yeah.
That's your honor to you, sir.
But that's what it is. It's like a show. It's almost like a street thing, a street theater, street gang almost.
Well, so that's sort of where I was going. Okay, so fine. You're a member of his crew, and so you have a certain
I wasn't.
I know you. I'm just the a person who's a member of his crew has a person affinity sort of affinity for him.
Right.
But you know you're in a gang, right? Or what do you think? You think you're in a civic organization? What do you think you're in when you're part of Verdoliak's crew or Madigan's crew or Burke's crew?
Why don't you go watch this movie called The Departed. What was it called? The Good Shepherd.
Yeah, Matt Damon. Yeah,
Matt Damon playing George Bush, starting the CIA, basically.
Mm-hmm.
The WASP starting the CIA. And so they show up at Joe Pesci's house to talk about something like we're going to kill Castro or attack Cuba. And Pesci in the backyard, sitting there with a little espresso, says, hey, I know what we got. And I know, like, the blacks have their thing, the Puerto Ricans have their thing, all these different ethnic tribes he's mentioning. But what's your thing? He says to the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. And Matt Damon turns to him and says, we've got the United States of America.
Mm-hmm.
And all you're doing is passing through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in a way, that kind of thing is real or was real for many years. And so you can't expect urban people groups to think otherwise.
Well,
so they get their guy. They get their champion.
And so so some of the responses to what I said include this. Fleecing his neighbors, ? Normally, I agree with you, meaning me, but I think you'd be hard-pressed to find somebody on the south side of Chicago who has a bad thing to say about him. You obviously know nothing about his personal life and his relationships, etc. Well, I guess my point is, yes, I understand that he took care of his people, but it was at the expense of everybody else. And so I don't think I'd be hard-pressed to find somebody outside of the South Side, outside of his crew, to say something negative about him. But of course, internally, for the people he stole on behalf of and then redistributed a small percentage to.
You want to get people to hate that don't like him? Ask David Axelrod, Basil Talbot, if he's still alive, Sweet, all these people.
Yeah, but that's because of the Harold Washington days.
Even before. The press in Chicago, just like the Washington press, is really about genuflecting to authority, as you've pointed out many times.
Right, of course.
And Brdoljak fought daily. Richard J. Came up by fighting for committeemanship, defeating Daley's candidate for Democratic committeeman of the 10th Ward. Back in those days, the old man Daley referred to everybody. He'd refer to a Proft or to a Cass as Polacks. Mm-hmm. I don't even know if you can say that anymore. No offense. But that's everyone was that to him. And Brdoljak was that.
So that excuses shaking down the University of Chicago hospital system. I'm not saying you. I'm saying in the reaction you get here. Here's another one, just to give you an example. And this is it. Cut me in or cut it out. This is the Chicago culture. By the way, it is a death culture politically, culturally. Another one. I caddied for him many times as a kid. Ball buster, but good guy. Tipped well and got me out of a legal issue when I was 20.
He got himself out of a legal issue when he was 21. I think he was suspect in a murder at the University of Chicago.
Sure.
Law school, though. Law school.
Oh, no. I understand he's an officer of the court, like all those, like the judges who were bartending for him at his barbecue.
I think
officers of the court.
The thing about writers is that we like interesting fighters, interesting politicians, rogues. But because the others are so bland and in their corruption. He wasn't, and he was an interesting fellow.
Well, I understand that he's,
I'm not defending. I'm just trying to put him in context.
I know. I know you're not defending. We're getting past that. This isn't responding to you personally.
It's not all about me.
This flamboyance. So it doesn't.
A Frank Sinatra thing.
Yeah, but with that, therein lies the problem. The romanticizing of it.
Yeah.
And that's what the press corps does. I mean, vilifying / romanticizing,
right.
And sometimes the vilification aids and abets the romanticizing.
I got sucked into it when I was a kid. You know, I was covering him when I was 24, 23, and he was the de facto mayor of the city. You think Jane Byrne was the mayor?
Right.
Please.
Right.
All right, so it was just a fascinating time. Make a great novel. Great TV show for Netflix. Maybe Obama. Hey, Barack, I know you listen to Dan. Could you produce this thing for me?
Well, and then I remember, too, when the Republican Party, such as it is, this is going back 30 years.
Right.
Well, but in Chicago, they prostituted themselves
of course.
To Ed Brdoljak. Oh, Ed Brdoljak's a new Republican.
He's a white guy. White guy running against a black guy.
He's a Republican.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
There is no Republican Party.
No, I know, but
John Cass has said that so long that even Dan Prof believed it.
But this is 35 years ago.
Yeah, sure.
He's a Republican. You want to understand why there's no Republican Party. I mean, here's another case study. Prostituting yourself to Ed Brdoljak so you can say we've got a serious candidate for mayor. No quality standards.
Right. Or let's put a liberal up there from Hyde Park. And he'll turn into a racist. His name is Bernie Epton.
Yeah.
This town is so screwed up, I can't.
So, but on the Ed Brdoljak thing, I mean, not to put you on the spot.
Please
I don't want
do.
You to endify to
please do
to offend his crew.
Oh no, I'm not
who caddy for
don't
him.
Worry.
And
don't worry.
I know you're not worried.
I told you that story off mic about Betty wanting to cut his heart out with a paring knife.
And Betty, your wife.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh.
So was the city better or worse because of Ed Brdoljak?
The city did not change because of Ed Brdoljak. The city is worse because of Republicans who thought he was like that, like you just mentioned. Oh, we have a candidate. The city is corrupt to its core. And the elite, the moneyed class, that the same crew that tried to push Bill Daley on the city for mayor, and some of us fought it and lost, that same crew, the same crew that had Bill Cellini running the Republican Party while Jim Thompson was, I don't know what, singing in African-American choirs, promising not to raise taxes again and doing so. That city started its corruption so long ago that it's forgotten its own name. It's forgotten. It's lost its soul, and it's going down the drain as a result.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and in for Amy J this morning, John Cash, johncashnews.com. We're talking about Fast Eddie Verdoliak going up the river again for 18 months following a conviction on income tax evasion. And just that is the jumping off point to do a pretty interesting, I think, historical dive on Chicago with John. Ron in Salem, Wisconsin, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, guys. You guys make a great team. Hey, I tried working for the Republican Party or volunteering for the Republican Party when I was younger. It made me sick to my stomach. John's right. There hasn't been a Republican Party for over 35 years. John, you need to write that novel. Maybe it'll become a PBS series on WTTW.
You don't think Barack Obama would help me out?
Oh, produce it, part of the Netflix deal they got.
I think I'll write a column on it this week. So, Dan, thanks for giving me the idea. And Ron, because I'm always up for ideas.
We didn't even get to the point about Verdoliak, this part of his storied career as a grifter. Him being counselor to Betty Lorne Maltese and Cicero.
And you never heard about who paid for the funeral and wake of the lonely Clarence McLean, former pimp, panderer, bewigged, chief information officer for the reform candidate, Harold Washington, the reform mayor. When Clarence McLean died, he was friendless and alone and penniless. And who paid for his funeral? I was there, I know. Who paid for the wake? It was me and Clarence in his bad wig, alone in a room. Ed Verdoliak. Odd, isn't it?
Did he also buy the Cadillac coffin for Willie the Wimp? I mean, you can put that on his credits, too?
I don't think Eddie would disrespect a Cadillac like that.
I'm thinking about what Ron from Salem, Wisconsin said, though, too. I mean, this does set up for like a Boardwalk Empire type series, because I mean, that's the most recent show I can think of where you have, you know, the politicians are the crime lords. I mean, the office holders.
Well, that's why I didn't like that show, just like I didn't like Kelsey Grammer and Boss.
You didn't?
No. You know why? Two reasons. Or one reason. In Boardwalk Empire, they didn't say the name Paul Rica.
Okay.
And Paul Rica, for all his life, he couldn't laugh in English, but he knew how to name Chicago Cermak Road after the mayor he killed. And until his dying breath, there was only one boss of organized crime in Chicago, and that was Paul Rica. And no one mentions him, and I tell people why not. They don't mention him because that's what organized crime is. Like Tony Soprano wanted Junior to be the boss. Go ahead, he's the boss. He's the face guy.
Well, so that's you had the same problem with both the boss and Boardwalk Empire.
Yeah, I had a problem with although I did like that opening season with the ears. You know, where the character looks like Danny Solis or somebody like that.
Well, yeah.
Gets the ears from his cousin.
Well, and the definitive line. The definitive line from Boss.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Change on the outside to protect continuity on the inside. That is Chicago.
That is the Chicago way.
Quickly, before we have to jump, the definitive book on Chicago, if people want to get, you know, at least to begin to get a working knowledge of the history of how deep this is.
This sounds like something Mayor Lightfoot asked me once. I would say the one book, find it. It's called Captive City by Ovid Damaris. It was written in the 50s.
You turned me on to that. The other one I thought you were going to say was Gus Russo's The Outfit.
But that's a clip job.
Yeah.
I like Gus, but it's a clip job.
This is The Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J this morning, John K, John Cass, johncassnews.com, Chicago Way podcast.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you. And John, you're in trouble at the CDC when you're starting to lose those who were actually promoters of lockdowns initially, like former FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb. And they're starting to lose them because the last week in particular has been such an excrement show. It really has. Culminating on Friday night with the interview we previewed on Friday morning that Brett Baer would do of Rochelle Walensky, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, the CDC director. And he did. Here's the explanation you get from Walensky on the change in mask guidance.
So what we did is we looked at other sites that were conducting outbreak analyses and discussed with some international colleagues who are ahead of us on the Delta variant to see what we could glean. And what became very clear is that the data that we saw in Massachusetts were corroborated in numerous other places, and that's when we knew we had to take action.
It's all about Provincetown.
Where's the study? And, okay, we talked about this during the break. There's so much going on with this mask, not mask. You're going to have your kids' masks again. You're not going to, it's not going to kill you. It's going to kill you. Cases up. It's coming so fast. The average guy like me, I think of myself, an average guy on this, I can't make heads or tails out of it. And it's kind of like listening to DaBaby at full volume, and I never have. You know, you want to turn it down. And just like, what did the White Sox do?
Well, here's the. I think you're right. I think that's a good point. And so, what's the reaction? If you're trying to listen and assimilate all this information, the takeaway you get is that they're all over the place.
Yeah.
And there's nothing succinct, sort of top line takeaway. So on mask guidance change, that was explaining the change, kind of, sort of. And here's something else too, which wasn't asked, but should have been. How do you make a change without showing your work first or showing your work at the same time?
Right, where's the study?
There wasn't any, and so you're fishing around for, you know, exactly what the CDC is saying, as Brett tried to do again. How does wearing a mask, which the vaccinated didn't have to do, and they're now recommended to do, how does that help them?
So for the masks to be added to that, are the vaccinated people wearing the masks to protect the unvaccinated people, or are they protecting the vaccinated people?
The vaccinated people, so if you are vaccinated, when you are vaccinated, you are protected from severe disease and death. And when we removed the masks in May for the vaccinated people, the Alpha variant was the predominant variant. And we had data to suggest at the time that if you were infected as a breakthrough case, that you couldn't give disease. You couldn't give Alpha disease to someone else. Fast forward now, the end of July, the predominant strain here is Delta. And so what we were, the data that we saw was actually unlike Alpha, Delta allows you to transmit to somebody else. So the masks are really being put on for vaccinated people in areas of high density disease, such that if they were to get infected, that they knew that they might bring it to somebody who is immunocompromised, somebody who was not yet vaccinated. So it was really to prevent transmission.
It doesn't prevent. Okay, here's the thing. I don't get it. Does it? Do wearing masks, according to Fauci-Stein or whatever is Franken Fauci-Stein, does it stop you from transmitting, or does it not?
That's what they suggest. They suggest that it does stop transmission.
Stops or you significant, from coughing all over the elevator.
Or significantly hinders transmission. But the studies that have been done on this in terms of the real world, how people are wearing masks, and even some studies where the control group and the experimental group, they're more conscientious about mask wearing than actually exists if you've ever gone to an airport or any other place that's highly populated with a lot of people wearing masks.
I've just been in one.
So all this starts from, you're supposed to start from the premise that masks stop transmission, and I don't start from that premise because the science, you know, magic incantation, science solves all of our problems, is dubious on it. That's just the fact. Rochelle Walensky then pressed on, okay, you're talking about transmission, you're talking about cases. Because remember, the baseline is you're vaccinated, it prevents serious illness and death. You may get reinfected, presents serious illness or infected or reinfected, but it prevents serious illness or death. So then where are we, you know, contextually here? Hospitalizations and fatalities. That's what we were trying to slow the spread over a year and a half ago. Slow the spread to prevent.
The fear.
And that's where we're at now.
They're spreading the fear, definitely.
Yeah, well, right. They're not slowing that spread.
So I think it's really important to recognize that as we think about the absolute number of people who are getting infected, that is related to the number of people who have disease, the number of people who are vaccinated, and how well those vaccines work. So it is actually quantitatively possible to have 95% protection from hospitalizations and still have a lot of breakthrough infections if most of your population is vaccinated.
But is there a normalcy? I mean, is the next variant just around the corner? And is that something, you know, that we're always going to be on this stop and start with putting masks on or not?
So I want to just articulate that this was not news that I expected the American people to welcome. This weighed heavily on me to have to do this. But I will also say that this virus has been humbling. I was taking care of patients a year ago. I joined the CDC 6 months ago, and the science continues to change.
I'm sorry, Brett, that's not a non-responsive to the question. He said, what is the threshold?
I don't care about your feelings.
What are percentages? It's like, oh, you know, we thought about this very. It hurts my heart. This sort of, you know, despotism with a smile. This compassionate tyranny.
Sentimental barbarism.
What about the hospitalization rate? And you get that sophistry, that emoting.
95%. She did. The words 95% came out of her mouth.
Yeah,
right?
Essentially, if you have 95% are protected, you still have a problem. Well, I don't think so. And you know, this kind of gooey speak is what generates stories like this terrible, ridiculous, embarrassing story out of the Chicago Tribune. Apparently, it's still in print. I had no idea.
Uh-oh.
Chicago issues indoor mask advisory for everyone over 2. Yeah, they're recommending.
Do you ever try to put a mask on a 2-year-old?
You shouldn't try.
No, but I mean,
I know
you can't get a 2-year-old to do anything.
COVID-19 cases up nearly 50% in Illinois over the past week. So, first of all, the metric is hospitalizations and deaths, not cases.
That's what you think the metric is.
Well, that's
not what the fear mongers think the metric is.
That's what they were saying. The metric was when this outbreak occurred, and now they've changed it, and they're not explaining why they've changed it, number one. Number two, up 50% in the past week, 200 cases a day. So it went from 133 cases a day to 200 cases a day in a city of 2.8 million people, and we're supposed to run around like chickens without necks.
Are people dying as a result of it?
Well,
are more people dying?
I'm glad you asked that question. Because our friend Martin Kulldorff, an actual infectious disease expert at Harvard Medical School, at the same time all this alarm is mounting, the actual number of COVID-19 deaths is at its nadir. In the USA, COVID mortality is now the lowest since the start of the pandemic in March 2020. And he tweeted out a chart actually from Our World in Data. Deaths per million at extreme lows. So hospitalizations and increase in hospitalizations in some areas of the country, are they a concern? Sure, they're a concern. but only to the extent they lead to high numbers of deaths. I mean, I know the sort of anomalous long COVID cases, but we're really talking about hospitalizations and deaths. Hospitalizations are a concern. You don't want people to get seriously ill, of course, and you certainly don't want people to die. But there's just no indication that that's happening at this point. Jay Bhattacharya, a Stanford medical professor, it's striking that COVID mortality is at such low levels, despite the fact that we're seeing an increase in the case in cases of late. By immunizing the elderly and many other vulnerable people, we've provided them with excellent protection against severe disease in case they get infected. Also contributing is widespread natural immunity from recovered COVID-19 patients. Though cases may rise, deaths will no longer follow in proportion. We have effectively defanged the disease with our successful vaccination rollout.
Nature may have already done that by killing 500,000 Americans.
So
the most vulnerable are already dead.
Well, it's not a single thing. It's a combination of all of the above. And yet, despite what you hear from Jay Bhattacharya, for example, here's what you hear from Rochelle Walensky, CDC director, on a federal vaccine mandate.
The best way to stop a new variant from spreading is to have less virus out there. And the best way to do that is to get people vaccinated and to mask up until they are.
Are you for mandating a vaccine on a federal level?
That's something that I think the administration is looking into. It's something that I think we're looking to see approval of from the vaccine. Overall, I think in general, I am all for more vaccination. I have nothing further to say on that except that we're looking into those policies. And quite honestly, as people are doing that locally, those are individual local decisions as well.
Yeah, thank you for doing the federal government's bidding for us.
I have something to say. All the left, including the pundit class, who screamed endlessly, 24/7, year after year, about authoritarianism. Where are they now? Are you now?
They're saving lives now, so it's different. This is authoritarianism with a smile and a "we care about you. We're here to save you."
Useful idiots. Sorry, but
Holman Jenkins writing the Wall Street Journal about this. Unlike the U.S., Britain isn't flipping out about and flipping around in the half dark about what's going on, because they've seen a Delta surge, too, in the U.K. Thanks to biweekly blood sample surveys, the U.K. government knows how many people have antibodies from vaccination and or infection. Thanks to surveys and modeling, they also have a good idea how many are currently infected, invariably a multiple of those who get a positive test. Mm. We don't have that. And this has been pointed out by, again, Dr. Scott Gottlieb, among others.
Could we have it after the 2022 midterm elections?
Well, I mean, again, so comparing the situation in Britain to here is perhaps instructive, considering we've got 164 million people vaccinated. And we pretend like, you know, there's this significant super spreading cohort that is rampaging through the country despite this. Of particular interest, Holman Jenkins writes, are the antibodies of younger Brits, a majority of whom until recent days had yet to be vaccinated. As of the middle of June, 32% between the ages 16 and to 24 reported receiving the vaccine. 60% tested positive for COVID antibodies. Because the older groups rushed to be vaccinated, this helped authorities understand the extent of natural immunity. For the record, 92% of Brits now show evidence of antibodies, which is to say evidence of protection. 92%.
Right.
And in America, Jenkins goes on, weirdly, we have to rely on guerrilla statisticians like Yun Yang Gu of MIT, who we've spoken with, to know how many might have COVID. Models aren't perfect, but they bring us closer to the truth than trackers that currently highlight a total of 35 million positive tests, when it's highly probable at least 130 million Americans have contracted the virus. As for the antibody total, that would tell us how near we are to herd immunity. Forget it. So the British government has a handle on the percentage of the population that has antibodies, as just described, and our government does not. And so now, as he said, we're groping or flopping around in the half dark about what's going on. And so this is why you have all of this gooey talk and this turnabouts on the various restrictions or recommendations of restrictions for COVID, including with the schools.
We're really good at gooey talk, aren't we, in this country now?
I mean, and
it's all about your feelings, and something out there is vaguely threatening, and we have to do something.
And there are no specifics, too. I mean, this is stunning what she had to say, Rochelle Walensky, about schools. The masks for schools. This is, you know, it is Groundhog Day with respect to these policies. It's the same talking points for policies that are all over the place. Same talking points. No matter what their policy recommendation is, it's always the same. This is the best. This is the best we can hope for.
Over the summer, we've had numerous summer school outbreaks that have occurred when masks are not worn. We've had jurisdictions have had to close schools because there are so many clusters happening in the school system. So my primary goal is to get all our kids back in person safely for full-time learning, and to do so and to be able to keep the schools open to prevent those clusters from happening in school. Right now, the best way to do that is to have everybody masked because we do have disease in the community. And hopefully, as we have vaccinations for kids and less disease in the community, we'll be able to scale back on the mask wearing.
We have disease in the community, so the kids have to wear masks. I mean, what is the evidence, again, of transmission in the schools? What is the evidence of kids or teachers, for that matter, getting sick and or dying? Well, you know, put this in context. The same way we put the adverse outcomes, as she puts, the adverse outcomes from taking the vaccine in context. It's a very small percentage. These are overwhelmingly safe. You know what else is overwhelmingly safe? A classroom. And it's a very small percentage in both transmission as well as bad outcomes from transmission, but that's not what she says, and she will not get specific. She just won't.
Over the summer, we've had numerous summer school.
Those aren't hospitalizations and those aren't deaths. Do you have a percentage of kids, young kids, hospitalizations and deaths?
You know, we are following that very carefully. What I will say
so you're following
is
it. What's the percentage?
Certainly, the kids do better than adults do. The older
Answer
people,
the
more hospitalizations have occurred in demographics that are over the age of 65. But we are seeing illness in some kids who get COVID, and it's illness at the rates or even higher than the rates of influenza. So
hospitalizations at the rates? Death at the rates?
Tell
the parents what's going on because they're gaslighting everybody.
Well, at the rates
I'm
of
sick of it.
At the rates of influenza, so then what's the protocol for the flu? If you're doing this for COVID, then what's going to be the protocol going forward for the flu?
Who runs this government? The Chicago Teachers Union? Who runs it?
Well, the not the Chicago Teachers Union, the
right.
But, NEA, you know, Randy Gunn. Yeah,
I want to get paid. I don't want to go to class.
Brett, try it again. Second try on schools to get specifics.
You know, I think that we have to, when we have seen in schools that when the children come into schools with disease in the community, it can spread in schools if the children are not masked.
And
there's
no support for that statement.
Just a general feeling. So how much of this has to do with the midterm elections? Let's just be, come on. How much?
If they think this helps, I don't know. But, I mean, I guess to your point, there's some people driving this. There's some people that fear addle. They've been afraid of their shadow from the beginning, and they continue to be. I don't know. But I don't see this. Maybe it's not reaching critical mass yet. You know, sort of when will the revolt come? Maybe it's not reaching critical mass yet. But I think it's not moving in their direction. Pat and Lockport.
Yeah, you know, having listened to you guys and a review of all the stuff that was on the news, I feel like my brain has turned into a marshmallow this morning.
Yeah,
me too.
But I did want to make a couple of quick points. Number one, if these masks have not worked in 18 months, how damn stupid is anybody to believe that they're going to? Number two, where's the test for the Delta? How do we know that it is Delta? This virus has never been isolated, so how could we have a variant from something we don't know actually exists? Number three, the PCR tests are crap because they're going to discontinue them December 31st. Well, if they're not good then, why are they good now? they've changed the rating or the time. I'm not a scientist or an epidemiologist, but they changed how the tests are being done. And then you've got some clowns that say we didn't have a flu season. Well, you dumbasses, it was all COVID. And where the hell are the parents too? Because if you are dumb enough to put this crap on your kid's face and expose them to pathogens, you're just as stupid as the crap that is coming out of the CDC and out of the teachers' union.
Right.
And as far as teacher, now one more point.
Thanks for the call, Pat. We got to go. I think the Amish texture summed this up nicely. I figured it out. You have to get vaccinated to prevent the virus, but then the vaccinated must wear a mask to prevent transmitting the virus they're vaccinated against to the unvaccinated. Simple. You got it? Makes sense?
Just remember.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J. This morning is John Cass, former Tribune columnist. Now you find his work at johncassnews.com. Also, podcasters, the Chicago Way podcast. Law firm taking legal action on behalf of Minnesotans opposed to critical race theory, who argue they've become victims of retaliation for speaking out against what they say is divisive and discriminatory curriculum and philosophy. The Minnesota-based Upper Midwest Law Center announced on July 30th it had filed complaints and lawsuits on behalf of clients who seek to end the propagandizing of CRT and the retaliation that accompanies it to inculcate it. This will continue to be a fight here as schools open in some form or fashion, at least some of them do, in just weeks. And it should be a fight. It should be a fight.
Are people going to fight or are they just going to bail?
Well, some people are fighting.
I mean, just bail.
No,
like, I'm not going to go through it. I'm just going to go Indiana, Wisconsin, somewhere, and so my kids don't have to go through this again.
Yeah, but the problem is you cannot run it. I mean, there's going to be very few places where you cannot run it. At some point, you're going to be compelled to stand and fight or to genuflect. I mean, it's just how ubiquitous it is now. And I'm not just K through 12, but also obviously in corporate America too.
So when does corporate America and corporate media characterize those parents who are standing and fighting as Nazis or mass murderers on a scale of?
Here again, I mean, that people think they're alone. I don't have time to organize parents and so on and so forth. Well, you have this outlet or outfits like this, this Upper Midwest Law Center, public interest law firm in Minnesota. You've got other public interest law firms like No Left Turn. You've seen the organizing everywhere from South Lake, Texas to Loudoun County, Virginia. So actually to California as well. We've talked to parents all over the country. So it is happening. The question is, will the pushback be equal to the force of the rapacious CRTers? I don't know. They, as you mentioned, John, they certainly have a lot of support in the media, and this has been going on for a long time. You know, we're always late to these fights, people who believe in free minds and a free society. Always late to these fights. As was pointed out by Professor Eric Kaufman from Birkbeck College at the University of London in a recent piece, citing the work of Zach Goldberg, who's a Georgia State University academic. You know, the use of the term racism and similar terms started to take off around 2015. So the identitarians, the neo-Marxists, started to claim the language, I mean, well before then, but it really started to spike. This is, you know, half a decade ago. And where have people been? Now they're just getting hip to what's going on because it's manifesting itself in the schools, as it inevitably will. Control the schools, you control the future. What caused this spike? Again, citing this piece from Kaufman. Social media and the new partisan clickbait business model and online journalism as the catalysts. Yeah, I mean, right, something that's sensationalized is more opportunity to get eyeballs. But
and narrowcasting.
And narrowcasting, right. But it's also, it's a reflection of the ideology of newsrooms. We know 84% to 92%, based on Gallup polling over the last 50 years, 84% to 92% of members of the so-called D.C. press corps have voted for the Democrat candidate for president during that time.
It's an excellent piece by Professor Kaufman, and I can't wait to hear what he has to say about George Soros and my situation, you know, with Kim Fox, $2 million.
Well, let's get right to it then. Professor Eric Kaufman, professor of politics, Birkbeck College, University of London, also the author of White Shift, Populism, Immigration, and the Future of White Majorities. Professor Kaufman, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Great to be here, Dan.
So, so a little bit of, you know, the run-up to where we are now. Let's talk about where we are now a little bit. Some survey research that's included in this piece you wrote over at unheard.com. Survey research you did about white and black Republican and Democrats' understanding of race in America. I thought that some of these issues, like the likelihood of dying at the hands of police and who understands what the real data suggests, was very interesting.
Well, yeah, I mean, part of this is just to see whether people could get basic facts right, you know. So, for example, what is the risk of a young black man dying from a police bullet versus dying in a car accident? And we have hard data on that's just a fact that it's about a sort of 6 to 10 times more likely for such a person to die in a car accident than from a police bullet. And so if you look, however, at who gets that question wrong, you know, something on the order of 8 in 10 African-American Democrat voters get that wrong. 9 in 10, because 1 in 10 are unsure. Only 1 in 10 get it right. Amongst white liberals who think white Republicans are racist, something like 7 in 10 are getting that question wrong as well. Whereas amongst, say, if you take white Trump voters, only about 15% get it wrong. So it's skewing people's perception. And this is coming out of that media, what I call the social construction of racism, which is due to that media narrative, which Goldberg tracks very nicely. The use of the term racism just spikes after about 2015 in major progressive news outlets like the New York Times and Washington Post. Actually, what you can see is the Times and the Post and the progressive outlets actually pick this up around 2014-15. Then you can see the LA Times and other outlets coming in on sort of 2015-16, and then eventually other news outlets. So yeah, it's definitely a line of influence coming from those elite progressive news outlets.
And is that because they are so many in the media are on the left, that that confirmation bias or whatever that is, where you measure something and then therefore change it in social sciences, that they're predisposed to see the reality that they want to see? And I'm just reading your line here in your piece. One reason for this was the media's desire to tap into the mythic script of a white officer killing a black suspect.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right, that is a sort of sacred identity for a lot of cultural leftists who are heavily overrepresented in the, you know, mainstream progressive news outlets like New York Times. So they're going to be very receptive to any storyline, as is, by the way, for example, the President of the United States, who sort of leaned into these statistically misleading stereotypes about the risks of being shot by police, which are like being struck by lightning, essentially, for black individuals who are unarmed, claiming, you know, during the Chauvin trial and afterwards, reinforcing these complete myths about you're at risk of being shot if you walk outside your home and you're black, you know. So it's as if the president were to say to people, you're at risk of dying from the COVID vaccine. Like it's essentially like leading into vaccine skepticism. Exactly the same thing, but in this case, it's seen as okay because that's a narrative that people believe in.
So with respect to, getting them, it'd be great to get a survey of the D.C. press corps, too, and see how many of them would get those questions right. I'm sure they won't submit to such a survey. But here's the thing, too, and we've talked about this before. The other aspect, you just mentioned a key word too, part of their identity. This is a sacred construct, the white police officer shooting the black suspect.
Right.
And so as race relations have improved over the last 50 years, now there is the demand for more instances of racism because we have to keep this going. So they will create the supply to meet their demand to promote their identity and essentially the agenda underneath that identity. Is that conspiracy theorizing, or is that reflective of what's actually going on?
Well, there is some. Obviously, there are a lot of racial hoaxes, racist hate crime hoaxes, which have expanded greatly in recent years. I think Wilfred Riley has a book on that.
Right.
But what I think we have here is simply the inflation of any one incident. So Zach Goldberg also showed that any police shooting or police killings of African Americans had 9 times the coverage of every police killing of white Americans, of which there are many more than of black Americans, at least twice as many. And so what it is sort of a magnification of the few instances that exist to create this false impression that there is this epidemic. That is a sort of moral panic that's being created and constructed. Of course, it's fed to some degree by citizen journalism and by the clickbait media model, and all of these sorts of things are contributing factors. But, of course, it falls on ideologically receptive soil, too.
Yeah, but right, exactly. But I mean, it's more than it's receptive. They're not passive, and I don't think they're willfully blind. I mean, you can't ignore the Tony Timpa case in Dallas. And without saying, you know, that does not, formally saying it, at least in your mind, this does not fit. This undermines what we're trying to do. We're going to ignore it.
Well, that's the fascinating thing is we had video of exactly a carbon copy of the Floyd case, even more egregious because the officers were joking about it. And nothing, right? So that kind of tells you all you need to know about the fact because it didn't fit the script. It was more or less ignored. And likewise, if it's black on black, it's also going to be ignored. So it's got to be a very specific configuration, white on black, that is going to be picked up in the media. And what's interesting, you can look at the opinion survey data that Goldberg tracked, and you can see that it's really only, for the most part, Democratic opinion that really changes between 2014 and 2021. The number saying racism is a big problem kind of jumps from 40 to over 80%, whereas it's pretty flat for Republican voters, and it's sort of in between for independents. So it just shows you kind of who is receptive to this new framing, partly because of the media they consume.
Speaking of media, I have a personal interest in a few of the paragraphs in your piece. You referenced the story about billionaire George Soros donating $1 million to racial injustice organization seeking to defund the police. And liberal billionaire Soros donated $33 million to social justice organizations, which helped turn events in Ferguson from a local protest to a national flashpoint. In the context of what we're talking about, where does Soros fit in all this? Is he fairly being discussed, or is he being perceived as a totem?
Well, I'm not hugely informed on exactly what I know he's given to these movements which have advocated for defund, which is ultimately responsible for the huge spike in murders and blight and minority businesses.
Exactly.
So it's got a huge. If you're going to be cynical about it, you could actually call the events, post mid 2020 as systemic racism. Actually, because who is it going to hit hardest, right? But anyway, I won't go there. What I would say is, I think this is a much. It's actually bigger than Soros. I mean, this is the mainstream papers taking editorial decisions, influenced ultimately from the universities. If you look at the post 2015, what's happened on campus? You know, the mobbing of Nicholas Christakis at Yale,
yes.
Sort of cancel culture. Now that is sort of an eruption that begins in the elite universities. But whose intellectual origins really go back to even the 60s and 70s with critical race theory, and that just sort of gestated for a while, and then suddenly explodes in 2015, and then it sort of spreads into these elite media institutions, and from there, of course, into corporations and elsewhere. So yeah, I think it's, I do think this thing has a sort of intellectual origin on campus, and then it's just the graduates going into these newsrooms, going into foundations, publishing houses, Hollywood, etc., and spreading these ideas.
He is Eric Hoffman, professor of politics, Birkbeck College, University of London, and author of White Shift, Populism, Immigration, and the Future of White Majorities. Eric, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Dan.
Hey, join us on the turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and in for Amy this morning is former Chicago Tribune columnist John Cass, who you can now find at johncassnews.com. Also his podcast, The Chicago Way.
Thanks for finding me, everybody. Need you.
Yeah.
Love you.
Yeah. We need you, your voice in Chicago, too. One of the lonely ones in the wilderness. Morning consult poll. Among voters of all parties, 53% of Americans now support the January 6th commission, but that's down from 66% back in June. So this was taken after last week's Star Chamber proceeding with those four Capitol Hill and D.C. Metro officers.
Don't forget Kissinger crying.
I won't forget.
Can't forget that.
No, we'll not forget the waterworks. So that's a significant drop, of course, being driven by Democrat partisans. Four out of five Democrats in favor. Only one in four Republicans in favor, and half of independents.
Why is that?
Maybe people were giving the D.C. political ruling class the benefit of the doubt. I don't know why they would, but maybe they were say, okay, well, what happened on January 6th was not good, not appropriate, and an investigation into it to answer unanswered questions that should be answered. Okay, let's see how they do. And then you saw the partisan spectacle that it was, and maybe I'm not so interested in it anymore if it's not going to be serious.
They know what it's about. It's about weaponizing that issue to drive Republicans further to the right and further away from mainstream. This is really an undemocratic and dangerous tactic.
Well, Michael Ferrone, who's one of the officers who testified and has been a staple on CNN, he went on with his buddy Don Lamone and they aired this call that he got that was reported last week. Threatening call. Michael Ferrone receives threatening calls. He's under, you know, death threats. The proverbial, I've received death threats, and you never really hear any evidence to support the claim, but you cast the person who's describing them in the victim status, which
Does
is what Scalise they see.
Did Scalise get a death call, threatening call, before he was shot by a lefty?
Yeah, I think the shooting was threatening enough. Ferrone, with Don Lamone breathlessly playing this call from ostensibly a Trump supporter that calls Officer Ferrone names, but threatening call, his life in danger.
Yeah, this is from Michael Ferrone, Metropolitan Police Officer. You're on trial right now, lying. And you want an Emmy, an Oscar? What are you trying to go for here? You're so full of shit, you little f***er. You're a little man. I can slap you up the side of your head with a backhand and knock you out, you little You're a punk. You're a lying. How about all that scummy black f***ing scum for 2 years, destroying our cities and burning them and stealing all that out of the stores and everything? How about that, and assaulting cops and killing people? How about that, you f***er? That was shit on the goddamn Capitol. I wish they would have killed all you scumbags, because you people are scum. They stole the election from Trump, and you know that, you scumbag. And you f***ing, too bad they didn't beat the shit out of you more. You're a piece of shit. You're a little you f***ing scumbag.
So I mean, I get emails like that daily.
I have trolls like that.
Yeah.
But they're all in their mommy's basement, just like that guy.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, this is not a defense of the call, but this is presented on CNN breathlessly. This is a solemn occasion.
Right.
Some goofball who's all worked up goes on an ad hominem tirade, and our democracy hangs in the balance.
But is that the,
come on?
So is that that's what you use as an excuse for what they're doing? When you have people like this, when you drive them, when you kick people to the margins of culture and society, this is what happens.
Well, the other thing, too, with Fanon is his name, Fanon, and the others who testified, you know, there's a lot of political statements in their testimony. That wasn't just law enforcement officers recounting what occurred, presenting factual evidence and for whatever determination or report that would be forthcoming. A lot of political statements, a lot of statements that were erroneous. So one of the officers who made with the waterworks had pointed out that Aquilino guy talking about he's still waiting for people who decried athletes who kneel before the flag. He's still waiting for them to decry those people that engage in violence, breach the Capitol, and so forth. What are you talking about?
I decried them.
They're everywhere.
I decried them.
The whole point about this is they're making a straw man argument.
Yes.
They're making an argument in the face of no one who disagrees that what happened at the Capitol was a desecration. Oh, was it so far as an insurrection? Did they almost topple the Republic? No, of course not.
You mean the guy with the horns?
Yeah.
And
is everybody similarly situated? All 75 million people who voted for Trump, all the thousands, tens of thousands of people that were there on that day, are they in the same camp as the QAnon shaman? No, that's not true either. People. But we can't be adults about this stuff anymore. For more on this, let's go to Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano for our weekly confab, VP of the Catherine and Shelby Cullen Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation and author of the recently released Brutal War, Jungle Fighting in Papua New Guinea, 1942. Jim, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Hey, good to be with you. You know, this just reminds me of there are so many issues which are just like the one you just framed where reasonable people might agree on the substance of the policy, whether it's this or changing the name of bases which are named after military bases are named after Confederate officers or on and on and on. And what's absent, though, is that's not what the debate is about. These have been framed as political power plays. And January 6th is a very clear example of that. They don't care about the truth. They're doing this because they see this as an opportunity to bash other people and increase their political power. But they want to frame the issue because they want you to defend something in which, of course, you have no interest in defending. This is not good democracy. It's not good dialogue.
Exactly.
And it's not the way to help people understand what's going on in the world. It's just playing politics with whatever, from kneeling in front of the flag to, dancing in your shaman costume.
But even, Jim, even more so than Megan Rapinoe's ridiculous antics, this, to me, is about giving license to pundits of the left to bash the hell out of 75 million Americans. And I wonder what the masters of culture, who some of whom have studied history, think about how it ends.
Well,
because to me, it ends badly.
Well, how it ends is what we're seeing. We don't know how it ends because we can't know the future. But what we are seeing is confidence in the institutions are declining because people are seeing the institutions as illegitimate, whether it is the university structure or mainstream media or popular culture like television and films or artists or athletes. And you can tell this because the progressives have tried this strategy on so many issues, but you walk down the line of kind of the dozen or so mainstream issues that Americans really care about: open borders, culture, the theory, wokeism. All these issues, the administration is completely underwater, and the left is completely underwater. Even this commission, where not only support for the commission are declining, but people are, if you ask people and survey them, they said, well, they would be much more interested in seeing people investigate the BLM Antifa riots than they would on the Hill. So what you're actually seeing is Americans in the polls are reacting negatively to these things, and their confidence in the institutions which are promoting them are actually declining. Unfortunately, this even affects things like the U.S. military, which has been widely regarded as the most respected institution in the country for decades. And because of all the woke and the political policies and playing politics with the military, you see confidence in the U.S. military as an institution beginning to decline.
Yeah, well, General Austin in his mask with his memorandums about social distancing doesn't inspire a lot of confidence about as you've talked about on this show before, the senior leadership of the armed forces.
Right, but again, it's the same thing. They frame this as, what do you mean? You wouldn't want to go after extremists in the armed forces? You don't want to go after racism in the armed forces? You don't want to go after sexual violence in the armed forces? And of course, the answer is no, we don't want to tolerate any of those things. But that's not why you're there. You are there to push a political agenda. You're not there to make these institutions better and stronger and better serve the American people. One is, people get that. And two is, the institutions that the left uses to push these, they're increasingly not seen as credible by many Americans.
Well, let's talk about another of those institutions, public health agencies, starting with the CDC. And here's what Dr. Rochelle Walensky had to say to Brett Baer on Friday night about whether the hot spots for the Delta variant, like along the border, whether perhaps migrants coming over from the southern border from a variety of countries that are unvaccinated, that are testing positive for COVID, whether they have something to do in contributing to that spike.
Do you know how the surge of illegal immigrants with COVID is affecting the overall rate? You know, it sounds like the percentages down there on the border are astronomical.
Yeah, you know, I would say that the percentages in the southern part of this country are really quite high, and I don't necessarily think we can attribute all of that to what's going on at the southern border. I think what we really need to do is spend our time getting our communities vaccinated, to getting our individuals vaccinated, to prevent disease from transmitting in our communities.
You know, it's really interesting, Jim. Dr. Walensky has no real interest in getting any specific information about migrants at the border, about kids in classrooms. She just likes to make general statements about threats or lack or non-threats, depending on sort of the posture of the administration with respect to those topics.
Okay. Yeah. We have had actually COVID hotspots in states with low vaccination rates. We actually also have COVID hotspots in cities with high vaccination rates.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the other thing is, okay, let's assume that, yeah, if you have low vaccination rates, you have a community that's more potentially open to being a hotspot. Well, why would you be dumping people that you know have COVID into that community? And the one thing we know is, for a fact, is we've had over a million people walk into this country. None of them have had proper health screening. None of them have proper health care. We know that COVID is rampant throughout Latin America. We know that COVID is rampant throughout the illegal population migrating to the United States. And we have the U.S. government consciously dumping these people in communities all over the United States. And they're not vaccinated. Many of them have not been tested. We know that none of them are likely to go and get proper health care. And to just dismiss that as, well, but that's, you know, as a non-factor in the COVID uptick, to me seems, from a scientist, to just dismiss that out of hand, that just seems like you're playing politics. And I think that's a great example of how people are not trusting the institutions themselves. So, you know, this is kind of a glass half filled, glass half empty. On the one hand, Americans are using their common sense and coming to much better conclusions than they're getting from these institutions that are supposed to be informing them. On the other hand, these institutions are failing us. So where does that take us as a nation? That's a great question.
He is Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, VP of the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for International Studies at Heritage and author of the recently released Brutal War, Jungle Fighting in Papua New Guinea, 1942. Jim, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
And he joined us on the turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Dan and John Cass in for Amy J. And John, this gentleman over at Not the Bee did a nice job of putting together a video to help you understand the President of the United States and learn to speak Bidenese.
As long as he leaves my butt alone.
Well, this whole...
I will not allow
the
wiping thing.
My butt's been wiped?
Yeah. No way.
This is very much in controversy. Let's play that again. Let's see what's on.
My butt's been wiped.
Yeah. Is it my butt's been wiped or my butt's been twet? See, here, he breaks it down for you.
Next, my butt's been wet. Now, a common error on this one is people put the stress on the wrong syllable. It's not my butt's been wet. It's not my butt's been wet. It's my butt's been wet. Say it. My butt's been wet.
My butt's been wet.
My butt's been wet, not my butt's been wiped.
My bus?
I don't know. I'll give you another example. This is like high level. This is a Bidenese, like a 300 level Bidenese course, right. But just as an example.
This is sort of advanced level Bidenese. Very long word, okay? This is what it is. It's a very long word. Are you ready? Truender dash dubba depressure. Truender dash dubba depressure. One word. Truender dash dubba depressure. Say it a little more quickly. Truender dash dubba depressure. Truender dash dubba depressure. President Biden, go.
I'll lead an effective strategy to mobilize Truender dash dubba depressure.
Truender dash dubba depressure.
It's helpful, isn't it?
Is that Archer and Pulaski or somewhere in Providence, Rhode Island?
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in for Amy J. this morning, former Chicago Tribune columnist John Cass. You can find his work now at johncassnews.com and his podcast, The Chicago Way, there as well.
Thanks, Danny.
And Tony Fauci, the good doctor, was on this week. Clinton Foundation Donor Zero had the week off, so Jonathan Carl sat in. He's at least a little bit more responsible. And this is what Fauci had to say to the question of the prospect that a lockdown may be
federal.
In the offing. Is that at
federal
least,
lockdown?
Well, you know, the recommended lockdown, and then, yeah. Of course, everybody dutifully complies, or most everybody does. The reporting has been that this is certainly a topic that they haven't ruled out. Here's what Fauci had to say.
John, I don't think we're going to see lockdowns. I think we have enough of the percentage of people in the country, not enough to crush the outbreak, but I believe enough to not allow us to get into the situation we were in last winter.
Well, it's interesting because Dr. Rochelle Walensky, CDC director, on with Brett Baer on Friday night, was asked the question about fall sports. Are we going to have an NFL season, for example? Here's what she said.
I mean, are we going to have an NFL season, an NHL season, an NBA season?
I am really hopeful that we will. You know, what I think is really clear is that if we unify together as a country, if we take the steps that are necessary to squash the amount of disease that is there now, mm-hmm. we can do so in a matter of weeks.
Obey.
I hope so. That sounds like somebody who's part of conversations where things like postponing, or delaying, locking down is still on the table.
Mom, can I have a dog? Can I have a puppy? I hope so. It depends on you, John.
Yeah. Well, it depends on you along with the neighborhood coming together in unity to raise the dog. It takes a village.
Support the January 6th commission to support motor voting, of course.
For more on this, as well as Trump's presidential predilections, we're pleased to be joined again by Andy Kroll, who's the Washington, D.C. bureau chief for Rolling Stone magazine. Andy, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning.
So what is the temperature on the Hill about CDC, you know, basically Walensky, Fauci, and Collins, this this weekly Sunday talkie show that they do on those shows, and the quality of their messaging, the policy reversals, and the quality of their answers to questions like lockdown, is that sitting well with members of Congress, particularly on the Democrat side, who may be more fearful about the midterms?
I mean, it's an ongoing headache among the Democrats that I've talked to about the changing communications and messaging coming out of CDC. And this is something that's been going on for more than just this administration, going back into the last one too, but it's specific to the CDC. It's about masks, it's lockdowns, it's you're free to live your life as we learned in May, and now we're pulling it back. I think it's also, there's a lot of frustration about even going just to last Friday when the CDC released this data out of Massachusetts about an outbreak up there, that the CDC sort of hyped the scariest part of this data, which was that breakthrough infections do happen, but did not really play up both the fact that almost no one was seriously ill. I think the hospitalizations were in the single digits and they were mild at worst. And that the vaccines work, which is the vaccines prevent an infection from being, you know, really dangerous or deadly. And the CDC instead says, oh, these breakthrough infections are happening. And so there's frustration about that as well. I will tell you, though, Dan, there is, from the folks that I talk to, little to zero appetite for more lockdowns. No one wants to do that. No one wants to hear that in their states. Obviously, members of Congress, the administration can't really do that. That's up to governors, state legislatures, local officials in the counties. But no one wants to do that at this point. No one wants to shut the economy down again. And they're going to look at every tool that they have to try to get this most recent spike under control without seeing what we saw during 2020.
Well, that's so interesting. On the one hand, you know, the problem they have with the Provincetown case study is that they've changed the metric to cases. So they can't mention, oh, but don't worry, because the 74% of people that were vaccinated in this cohort that were infected, you know, they're not seriously ill, they're not hospitalized, they're not going to die. They can't say that because cases is all we're supposed to care about today. We're not looking at hospitalizations and deaths the way that we did at the beginning of the outbreak last year. And the other thing, too, is, oh, there's no appetite for lockdowns on the left. That's so interesting because to hear those who moved to lockdown tell the story, it was the only choice they had. It was a wonderful choice. It was the right choice. And they defend that choice. So if it was the right choice last year and they're engaged in hysteria over Delta this year, like Rochelle Walensky, then why wouldn't it be the right choice again?
I mean, the vaccine situation is obviously different. I mean, the fact that we have half the country of all ages vaccinated, I mean, that's a different state of things than what we had in the middle of 2020 when the lockdowns first came around. I mean, I think obviously there's going to be some criticism of the stance toward lockdowns now compared to last year. I mean, I think obviously a year's worth of data, a year's worth of getting people vaccinated, or, you know, 6 months worth of getting people vaccinated really changes the picture quite a bit. But, you know, having lived through the lockdowns, having seen people's reaction, having seen the effect on the economy that one time last year, I don't hear any appetite, even though you still have Dr. Fauci not totally taking it off the proverbial table. I don't hear any appetite to go back to that.
What about
to go back to that measure?
Yeah. And what about concerns about schools, too? Because, I mean, I don't know. I think appetite is a lot less for, you know, 2-year-olds and up to be masked at school than it was last year, too. But that's the position CDC has taken.
Yeah, it is. There's no appetite at all to continue virtual learning and to deny students, you know, the youngest ages on up, the ability to go into school, to not only get their education, but to get that critical sort of social interaction with their peers. I mean, I personally think, and when I talk to elected officials, political consultants outside the Beltway in places like Wisconsin, Minnesota, Colorado, other states that are not getting, you know, the D.C. coverage all the time, school school lockdowns or the potential of school lockdowns is a huge issue, a political issue. And I think it's one that Democrats are nervous about. They were really nervous about it last year, very nervous about it this year. And I think they recognize that, you know, you're going to get a revolt in a lot of these suburbs where President Biden sort of overperformed and really helped him win the presidency if you try to do this halfway, half virtual, half in person. And I think there is every effort underway to try to get kids back in school full time when the school year starts. But there's not that much time to do that. I mean, it's August 2nd right now. School year starting up in a month or so. So maybe even less in some places. So I think that August is a really important month to try to get that figured out so that in-person school is the only option.
Andy, this is John Cass. I'm wondering, how do you think the national press will cover that tension that you just mentioned between the national teachers' unions and the Democratic office seekers? How's that going to play out, do you think? Is it there, because the last time it was all wrapped up in virtue signaling and hysteria and fear and what's best for the children. And clearly now, as you mentioned, parents are not all on board. So how do you think the national media will be approaching it?
What I think, John, and what I hope, and it's really something I'm thinking about personally too, is that national reporters get out to these cities, these suburbs, these states where this debate, and in some cases a pretty fierce debate, is playing out on the ground, in, right in front of you, where maybe a local union, a local, you know, teachers union affiliate of the, you know, one of the two big national ones, is wrestling with, its teachers are wrestling with, its reps are wrestling with, what, you know, what do we do and what's best for our students? And also, what are the political ramifications for the state legislature, the national politics, by, say, going back half virtual, half in person, or going back full in person, or some kind of mask policy for students, because there's an argument that the public health backs that up, and there's an argument that it doesn't, and there's data that says that it doesn't, and that it also gets in the way of a real education setting, environment. In Washington, I think there is a tension, but there are tight lips among senior Democrats who know how important the teachers union is to them.
Oh, exactly. Yeah.
Boots on the ground, yeah. But financially, of course. I mean, you know, big labor.
It's the shock troops.
A huge funding part.
Well, but that's the
thing. That far,
but. Well, but here's the thing. Here's the thing. Wait a second. Biden last week said, you know, still looking at federal vaccine mandate, but certainly states and localities, businesses, private entities, I'd like to see you go in that direction. That was essentially intimated by Rochelle Walensky in her interview with Brett Baron Friday night. And yet the flight attendants union, the pilots union, no vaccine mandate. The Randy Weingarten, at the national level, local big unions, teachers unions like Chicago, no vaccine mandates. They're opposed to vaccine mandates. So President Biden, how do you square that with what you're suggesting and what your allies are doing? You're not reading from the same hymnal here, are you?
You can't square it. And there's going to be a lot of pressure behind the scenes, and it's going to be behind the scenes unless those conversations break down and it has to go public to try to get those allies to get on board with, as you put it, Walmart, Disney, the Pentagon, the vast federal bureaucracy, all the employees there who are now either getting vaccinated or facing a pretty onerous testing regime. I mean, the Biden administration doesn't want, and I don't really think that they can, go forward with a nationwide vaccine mandate. Everyone gets it, you know, fiat from on high. They are going to look through private employers, through the federal government, through hopefully teachers unions as well, to try to, you know, press people through there to get the vaccine numbers up. I think it'll definitely work with private businesses. It'll definitely work with the federal government. But if you're going to be an ally and you're going to want things like a teacher union would from the Biden administration, the education department, and so on, they're going to get pressure from them in turn to try to get on board with these vaccine requirements as well. There's no doubt about it. It's just a matter of time, I think. And again, with the school year starting soon, there isn't much of that time left.
You reported for Rolling Stone that President Trump is talking to confidants. That was reported again over the weekend, an informal, quote-unquote, cabinet meeting. Mark Meadows talked about it, his former chief of staff, that he has made the decision that he's going to run again. At least he's going to run again as of right now.
I want to be clear, too. I did not go looking for this piece of Trump-related news when I started reporting the story. You know, as a reporter, I check in with all kinds of people all the time. And, you know, this was a little bit ago, a couple of weeks or so ago, and I just started hearing from my folks in Trump world. You know, he's telling people he wants to do it. He obviously told Sean Hannity in a town hall meeting that he had made up his mind. Didn't say what he'd made up his mind to do.
Right.
He said he'd made up his mind. But what I've been hearing from everyone is that, yeah, he wants to do it. He wants to get back in. He's obviously raised a ton of money. He's got, I reported back then he had about $85 million on hand at the end of April, but I think it's over.
It's like 100 $102
now,
million.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. $102 million. So, I mean, that by the way, is off the charts. That is unprecedented. That is vastly more than he had at this point in his first year of his first term. So he has the money to do it. He clearly has the shadow cabinet ready to go as well. Could change his mind, of course. Anything is possible. There's always, you know, there's plenty of time for 2024. So this is what we're hearing now.
Given the Democrat position, policy positions tanking in the polls from border to masks to, I don't know, critical race theory, all of it. Do the Democrats see Trump as their savior?
Not the ones that I talk to, John.
Really? They don't see him as a way to rally the troops in what Dan and I call the Chardonnay Antifa in the suburbs to get them, you know, have the bogeyman, the orange-haired bogeyman out there and scare them back into the fold for the midterms?
That I don't totally disagree with. I think that there is clearly a coalition, that President Biden put together in 2020 that did include a lot of growth in the suburbs. But the flip side of that is, at sitting here today, whoever comes out of the Republican 2024 primary, and obviously I feel a little sane even saying those words here in 2021, but whatever, that person is going to have to be, if not Donald Trump, someone in his mold. That is where the party is right now, and if the party stays there come the first half of 2024, whoever comes out of that primary process wins the nomination is going to be someone in his mold if it's not him. But if it's not him, that person doesn't have the celebrity, the track record, the star power, pure wattage that Trump himself does, you know, Ron DeSantis or Christine Noem. I mean, these are people who are trying to, you know, catch that wake and trying to build their own profile, maybe with an eye toward 2024 if Donald Trump, say, doesn't run. But no one can match what he can do. I mean, he got 74 million people to vote for him in 2020. So I still think there is more of a fear there right now than there is, let him run again and we'll just do what we did in 2020.
He is Andy Kroll, D.C. Bureau Chief for Rolling Stone Magazine. Andy, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate
thanks,
it.
Andy.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you. He joined us on the turnkey.pro answer line.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in Framey J this morning, John Cass. Get his work now at johncassnews.com. You can also get the Chicago Way podcast there.
It's all free for now.
Free for now. but you know, the guy's got to make a living. He's got to pay Illinois property taxes.
After all, as Don Barzini said, we are not communists. Although my former employer is selling theirs for, I think, 8 cents a week.
That's way overpriced. They're going to have to cut that. And that's not the only thing they'll be cutting, but I digress. We were talking to Andy Kroll, D.C. Bureau Chief for Rolling Stone Magazine, mm-hmm. at the end of the last hour. He reported earlier this month that per confidants of President Trump's, he has made the decision that he's announced he's made, but the specific decision is he plans to run again. He wants to run again. And this punctuated over the weekend by Mark Meadows, his former chief of staff, saying he has met informally with his quote-unquote cabinet. And think about $102 million in the bank. Think about President Trump leveraging at least some of that money, plus his personal popularity within many circles, to help Republicans win congressional and Senate seats in the fall, and the fall of next year, of course. And were Republicans to take control of the House and the Senate, with McCarthy in the House in particular as Speaker, what a springboard that would be for him to announce in early 23 that he's running for reelect.
Better if Jim Jordan were Speaker, but I digress. Yeah, I see where you're going.
And, you know, if Hillary Clinton can run twice or three times, she certainly wanted to run a third time. She had worn out a welcome losing twice.
If Lori Lightfoot can even consider it running again.
But after a loss, why not? Why can't Trump come back and run again?
Because Republicans want to win. And I think that's where, I don't know. I understand the wattage and all that, and mm-hmm. star power, mm-hmm. and I am worried that the combine wing of the Republican Party, the Cheneys, Adam Kinzinger with his crocodile tears,
Pierre Delecto, small wing.
Small wing, but they have money, and they'll try to reshape things, and that disgusts me, but
But he's sort of.
I think Republicans want to win, and they want a horse that they know is not damaged goods.
312-642-5600 turnkey.pro answer line 646-3636-DA turnkey.pro text line. Simple question: as we stand here today on August 2nd of the year 2021 AD. Are you inclined to push Trump to run again? Do you want to see Trump run again, or do you want to see him be a kingmaker? We ask this question intermittently, but, you know, you should, because there's so much that's transpired over the first 7 months of the year and where we find ourselves right now. Because, you know, these are contextual questions. At this point in time, who would be best to do what you would like to see done at the federal level?
Besides Dan Proft campaigning and saying to everyone again that he was born a poor black child.
That would be fun.
Which I never stop laughing about that.
Tom in Blue Island, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Dan, I know I've been pretty adamant that Trump's running again. John, big fan. My heart just fell listening to you saying that. In essence, you think Trump is going to be forced out by the Adam Kinzingers of the world?
I didn't say that, Tom. I said,
okay,
want him to win, and if he doesn't run, what I worry about is the combine boys, all of them. You know,
right.
Anyone in Illinois knows
that
they are. John,
and you guys both touched on it. I'm willing to accept Trump is not the president. I'm not willing to accept he lost. And I can still envision the T-shirt saying, let's win it three times in a row. It'll be like a new three-peat from the Chicago Bulls.
Mm-hmm. But do you want him to run again or not?
Absolutely. Absolutely, Dan. He's the face of the Republican Party. And that's why the Kinzingers and Cheneys hate him so much.
Thanks for the call, Tom. I mean, if not Trump, then
you
could have somebody like DeSantis, who has a lot of Trump's attributes.
How about Tom Cotton?
And many fewer of his flaws.
How about Tom Cotton?
Tom Cotton, potentially.
And then you run into the other problem.
Senators. I like governors.
I know, yeah. Actually, J.D. Vance, but elect him first.
Yeah, that may be a little quick turn. I mean, plus he's got a lot to do in Ohio. The closest to Trump would be DeSantis, but he just has a lot more polish and he's a lot more detail oriented. But that's not necessarily to say, and that's where I've been since the election, and since we started thinking about 22 and 24.
But you know what people want? They still want. They hate the thing that the media, and I am a member or was,
yeah,
of mainstream woke media, because I'm so woke.
Yeah.
Is that the people who voted for Donald Trump wanted somebody to kick them where it hurts.
Right.
Not themselves. They wanted all these, you know, just the smirky. They wanted the smirk wiped off their faces.
Right. And
they're tired of it.
And where do you think those people are right now?
I think they're still with Trump.
Yeah. And I mean, do you think, but you want to see my, you know, favorite phrase, you want to see somebody bring that bicycle chain back to that playground.
And corn pop.
And I do. And this is where, you know, I get pulled the Trump way. So DeSantis is sort of a, you know, revenge being served cold. Trump is it's being served hot and right between your eyes.
But you, as I see people lining up to weigh in, you point out basically a larger debate that's been going on in the Republican Party or on the right for a long time now, between the David Frenches of the world.
Yeah, well, that's, yeah.
And
that's nowhere.
And others like Sohrab Armani, great editor of the New York Post editorial page, who basically says, if you're going to fight, fight. Don't fight, you know, don't.
Right, but just using this as an example. So and you could use Cotton or Holly too, but, I mean, DeSantis is going to fight in his own way. Trump has, you know, a unique style. His is more like WWF, but he's actually landing blows. It's not fake. He's actually inflicting damage on the left, which is what needs to happen.
Like Gregor Clegane.
I just don't know if there's an instrument that's blunt enough other than Trump.
Might not be to excite.
And remember, this comes from somebody who was a Trump skeptic from the outset.
Well, I wanted Rand Paul. I didn't want Trump.
And I was Scott Walker. Tony in Downers Grove.
Hey, Dan and John. Hey, Dan, first, thanks for having Andy Kroll on, who, you know, just confirms that he could bring zero perspective to the table. But he did confirm that, you know, he hopes that the mandate could go through via businesses and other venues like that, unions. Well, that's already happening. As far as Trump goes, he has a great opportunity to be a kingmaker, but he's still a child. And I voted for him twice. Mm-hmm. And my fear is that he is going to run again, and there's going to be a lot of division, and it's going to take a lot to pull me back over to that side. So the question is, for someone like DeSantis, can he pull people like, well, he already has me, but can he pull people like the first caller you had onto his side that are showing zero objectivity because he's saying he can't accept the fact that Trump lost? It's those people that you have to bring in. You're never going to bring in the QAnon, the strong QAnon people.
Yeah,
they're going to vote for Trump.
You don't need to.
But you have to get people like me who are the ones, or people like me who didn't vote for Trump again, which is why he lost. That's the base part that caused him to lose the election.
Well, thanks for the call. I don't think you'd have a problem bringing people over to DeSantis' aside, because I'm not sure DeSantis runs if Trump runs. So,
and the Democrats are doing their best to destroy themselves every day. Look at what's going on in Chicago. Look at what they're doing nationally.
Well,
this
is why it's so attractive for Trump to come back, you know, to do I Shall Return MacArthur style.
Yeah.
And do it. I mean, what a story that would be. Remember, think about a guy who, you know, understands sort of a story arc in a entertainment perspective. I mean, a comeback win for the presidency after this disputed election and all that transpired. And he sees a landscape that is fertile for it because the left has gone so far hard left. And as Andy Kroll was acknowledging, the positions on so many issues are underwater with the populace.
so you can understand why it's attractive.
Actually, I noted it,
but I don't. But I, well, so did he. But I don't think you're going to have a problem if Trump doesn't run, because he's going to play kingmaker. And if he does run, if DeSantis ran and he somehow beat him, you'd have a problem getting behind DeSantis and as the nominee. I don't think many voters would have that problem.
Would kingmaker appeal to his vanity?
It could. I mean, if he does, I mean, remember, we're still 3 years away. It's a long time. He's a guy in his mid 70s. You know, those are all issues. Let's see where everybody is 3 years from now. See,
the other issue is
who knows?
Kamala.
I may not be here.
And the other issue is Kamala.
Time is promised to no man, John Cass.
Kamala Harris is not qualified to hold public office, let alone.
Well, I mean, to the extent that Kamala would be their nominee. And I don't think that's a foregone conclusion at all. That makes it even more attractive.
Right.
Nancy in Northbrook.
Hi. I'm going to say that I do not want Trump to run again. I don't think he had a very good campaign last time. It really wasn't. I didn't think it was a very good campaign. And I think his rhetoric after the election was really unforgivable.
Which part of the rhetoric after the election?
Saying that he won by a landslide.
Oh, yeah, okay. All right, okay. Thanks for the call, Nancy. Yeah, I mean, I think that's a criticism he's going to have to address, and the more he starts to get forward-looking...
The more we're going to find out about what he did to Mike Pence, throwing stuff in his face, all that stuff, which suggests to me that's not a personality. That's a personality you want in a... In a fight, in a bar fight.
Yeah.
Almost kind of like earlier in the show, we talked about Vrdoljak. Great tactical street fighter, bad strategic thinker.
Yeah. I basically agree with a lot of the people. I mean, I've been critical of his personality too. I find some of the stuff that he does very sophomoric, unhelpful, counterproductive. Talked about it over his term as presidency and since. But maybe that's what I don't know. Maybe I don't want to say America deserves, but you know, maybe this needs to be something that is unseemly and in the mud. And if it's going to be unseemly and in the mud, who best to fight that fight?
Look at what they're doing in the January 6th commission.
I mean, look at what we've chosen.
Yeah.
So this phony baloney stuff you hear from political hacks like Michelle Obama, is anybody really interested in taking the high road?
What high road? They could take the high road when they have the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, I mean not Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Washington Post, CNN, and all the other media that mocks people like you and me and those listening. Those reading me, and so they can say whatever they want.
Yeah,
but
they're not taking the high road. They're describing a high road they're not taking. But does anybody really want to take the high road in America, in American politics?
I don't think so. No.
Yeah, who is really promoting going back to sort of like Lincoln Douglas debates and all this?
Lincoln Douglas debates led to the Civil War. So, the media wants Republicans to be like Bob Michael. Okay, they want Republicans.
I know what the media wants. I'm not talking about the media, but fold into everybody. Is there anybody who wants this firing line type of political culture? Does anybody really want that? They say they want it, but I don't think they do.
Well, the stakes are higher now. The stakes are that if you care about your child. And that your 8-year-old little girl told by her teacher and her peers that she's a racist because of the color of her skin, that she's an oppressor, and you don't start fighting about it, no one else is going to fight for it.
Mm-hmm. We all live in broken homes, avoid houses of worship, spend much of our time alone staring at screens. Liberalism finally got what it's always wanted, a gaggle of detached and uprooted people, alone and scared witless, seeking solace and suspecting that someone somewhere is out to get them. call it woke culture if you'd like, but it's nothing more than the Enlightenment's apotheosis. And it's exactly why folks everywhere from Warsaw to Wisconsin are voting for candidates who promise little more than a swift kick in the pants to the liberal order.
It's the liberalism stupid, I think, right?
Yeah, that's Leo Leibovitz writing in Tablet. Very good piece. But, I mean, if that's who we are, then what can we come to expect? What should we expect? What should we even desire, perhaps, other than Trump rooting around in the dirt with some, you know, off-the-shelf neo-Marxist? Bill in Lincoln Park.
Hey, Dan. Hey, Mr. Cass. Hey, I'm not for Donald Trump running for president. Any guy over 68, I don't want them running. Obviously, look at the current guy in there in office. I get the argument back, well, what about Ronald Reagan? I said, well, Ronald Reagan had his head together. Plus, he was out by the time he was 78. But besides that, Donald Trump can bring a lot of I agreed with a lot of what Donald Trump said. He said things that people said, yes, I understand that. I get that. And he said things that, like a Kissinger would dance around for 20 minutes on the dance floor, but Trump was a straight, like Pat Buchanan, he was a straight to the point, said it. Yeah, he offended a lot of people, but he drove a wedge straight to the point. Donald Trump can, in closing, Donald Trump can contribute endorsing a lot of politicians, a lot of people on the right into office, no doubt in the midterms in about a year and a half, less than a year and a half from now. But until then, I just don't see him as president, guys. Oh, and by the way, the Vodoliak thing was a great class in political science. Thanks.
Thank you, Bill. Man. Thank you, Bill. I'll post that, John and I talking about Vodoliak going to the joint again.
I guess I'll write about it.
538 hour, yeah. So then you read johncastnews.com's take on it, and you can listen to our back and forth on it. We'll post that on my Twitter account. Alan in Rockford.
Hey, guys, how you doing? I don't support a Trump rerun. Looking in the mirror, as we should, my feelings are is we really lived a vicarious life of getting even with the bully, a.k.a. the left. Mm-hmm. And Trump did that for us for 4 years. It's time to get down to business. I agree with your opinion about DeSantis, a guy that's polished like that. And the thing I like about DeSantis is he's a learning individual. He sits down, he reads, he studies, and he really figures out what is the best path to go forward. Whereas, Trump is an emotional guy. He shoots from the hip. And I think that really caused a lot more problems than it solved over those 4 years. And I just don't want that drama back in the White House again. We need to focus on the national debt. We need to focus on reining in the size of government. I mean, all this. Dan, I know people who are making six figures a year that are getting $250 a month for their kids. It's insane. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't be happening. And we have to get somebody in there like a DeSantis who can rein that all in and get back to the business of running the government to the benefit of the country following the constitutional principles.
All right, Alan, that's a thoughtful perspective.
Thanks, Alan.
That's very good.
Thanks for writing my column for me.
I just don't. Yeah, but I don't. I don't think that's where the majority is.
I don't think so either. I've always been an outlier.
You rebel.
I was for Rand Paul, for God's sake.
And you were for Ron Paul before him.
No, I was not.
All right, Grant in Rockford.
Hello, fellas. Good morning. Good to hear your voice again, John.
Thanks.
I like Trump. I'm the Trumpist, but I have to say, I think he's damaged goods. Just from the callers that are calling in, I'd vote for him again in a heartbeat, but he turned too many people off, and the media did too good of a job destroying his brand. I mean, I just can't imagine all the limousine liberals. They're just frothing at the mouth waiting to see him again. And they've destroyed him, so I could see DeSantis. I'm with you 100%, Dan. Trump was kind of our Batman in 2016. He wasn't the hero we wanted. He was the hero we needed kind of thing. So I'd like to see a Trump-DeSantis rally. I think that would bring people out of the woodwork. And you get Trump off to the side, and life's good. So have a good one, guys.
Thanks, Grant.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan, and in Framie J this morning, former Tribune columnist John Cass. You can get his work now at johncassnews.com, and you should sign up there, as I did. Also get the Chicago Way podcast there.
Thanks, Dan.
We have heard from Dr. Tony Fauci. We have heard from Dr. Rochelle Walensky. Dr. Tony Fauci said no lockdowns will be needed. Not that I go running to the bank with that. Dr. Walensky, on the, conversely, saying she hopes there will be an NFL and NBA season this fall into the winter. Hopes there will be.
Just get the Sox into the World Series, okay?
How about we hear from NIH Director Francis Collins, the third member of this troika. He was on Fox News Sunday. He's got some good news for you, John. He's got some bad news. Would you like to hear the good news or the bad news first?
Whatever. I'm just the subject.
Bad news. Let's get the bad news out of the way.
Delta is spreading. We know it's extremely contagious. And certainly in some parts of the country, like Missouri, Arkansas, Louisiana, it is reaching very high levels. And we are now once again seeing case levels per day closing in on 100,000, which we haven't seen since February. So this is really a different virus than last year. And everything we learned about COVID a year ago, you got to sort of hit the reset button on now how we need to react to it. We also are learning, and this is not particularly good news, that vaccinated people, if they get infected, which is rare, but it does happen, they have pretty high viral loads, which means they could also be passing it on to other people. Even though they have a very low risk of getting seriously ill themselves, they can be a vector. That was the reason for CDC saying it's time in those places where the virus is spreading, which is about 75% of our counties, to put the masks back on when you're in indoor space, where whether you're vaccinated or not. This is the best way to stop the transmission of this very contagious virus.
Yeah, that was the real bad news. Their talking point that what we have now is an endemic of the unvaccinated sort of went away when it was learned that the viral load in the vaccinated mirrors the viral load, the Delta variant mirrors the viral load in the unvaccinated in places like Provincetown. Okay, well, so that's the bad news.
Good news is that you could get on the L without a mask with all your other stone friends, right, after Lollapalooza and hang out.
Yeah.
Until they tell you to mask up.
And other good news?
The good things. The vaccines work extremely well, including against Delta. If you're vaccinated right now, your chance of getting infected by this goes down by at least 3.5-fold. Your likelihood of having symptoms goes down by 8-fold. Your likelihood of getting really significantly ill in the hospital goes down by 25-fold. That's an extremely encouraging new set of data from the real world where we're tracking this. So vaccinations are still our best hope, and they are working beautifully. But, of course, we need to be sure more people take advantage of that. So the other part of the good news that I'm happy to see is I think we may, Dana, have seen a tipping point now where vaccinations are going up every week. 56% increase in vaccinations in the last couple of weeks, especially in those areas hardest hit. Goodness, Louisiana has tripled their rate of vaccinations in the last couple of weeks. That means people are finally sort of saying, okay, I've waited long enough. Let's do this.
Mm-hmm. That's the good news and the bad news, according to NIH Director Francis Collins. At least he is the most plain spoken of the three members of the troika. The others, you get all sorts of middling abstractions. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined again by Jeffrey Tucker. He's the editorial director for the American Institute for Economic Research and author of Liberty or Lockdown. Jeffrey, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Sure, and I agree with you about Collins. At least it was coherent English.
Yes, that always helps.
it's kind of gibberish otherwise. I mean, you know, that's all that stuff he was saying, none of it needed to be said. You know, we've understood for a century how mutations of mostly mild viruses among most people, you know, work. They're more widespread, they're less severe. It's not a surprise. None of this is even slightly interesting. This is all just kind of ginned up panic, and I don't know why it's happening. I think we're addicted to panic. We're addicted to reorganizing all of our lives to avoid infection. Which is, I think, just sheer folly.
Well, and this was Andrew Sullivan's point, an interesting piece that he wrote at his Substack, Let It Rip. And he says, the key question, do we really want to get back to living?
I do.
Yeah.
So take the rational precautions, a solid vaccine, go about your business as you always did. Yes, I'll wear a mask indoors if I'm legally required or politely asked, but I don't really see why anyone should. In a free society, once everyone has access to a vaccine that overwhelmingly prevents serious sickness and death, there's no reason to enforce lockdowns again or mask mandates or social distancing any longer. In fact, there's every reason not to. Now it's time for people to make their choice.
Yeah, I like that article. It was good. I mean, I have my problems with that. I mean, I think he doesn't understand about natural immunity. Natural immunities are generally, and we know this, we didn't need to know this, but we already knew this, but it's been shown again and again, natural infections more broad and efficacious and safer with vaccines. And you know, it's probably the case that 130, 150 million Americans have by now natural immunities that are quite efficacious and, you know, and not in need of a vaccine. But, you know, nonetheless, that article was good, and I liked it. I think it was a good piece. We have this extreme distorted view of life today. You know, that I just read a letter in the Washington Post by a woman who said, me and my son, we huddled in our home for a full year and had our groceries delivered by whom? She doesn't care. We had our groceries delivered for a full year, and then I let down my guard, and I went to the grocery store without a mask, and then sure enough, oh, by the way, she also had been vaccinated, right? Sure enough, I got sick. Now it's true I'm not in the hospital, but I tell you what. I have a cough.
So
and a headache, and I can't taste my morning coffee. So I'm just heads up, people. Heads up, wear your mask. All right. So
you have the you have this fear or this addiction to fear and fear porn throughout the culture.
Yeah.
A culture that did once celebrate the individual, the cowboy. My favorite show, Alone, where survivalists try to live alone. And instead, now we're terrified of everything. And then you have this paragraph in your piece in Real Clear Markets. I pity anyone who took a few weeks vacation from the news during this period. We went from believing that the whole point of the vaccines was to protect against infection to realizing that this was not the case. Now, I'm one of these people that when I hear the squawking on this subject, I tend to turn down the volume and think about like the U.S. men's soccer team because I just can't handle it. It's coming at me left and right, faster and faster, and I'm a news guy. I'm a newsman.
Yeah. No, I agree. It's too much. In particular, on the point I just made there, what really matters here is that there was such a push for a vaccine because people thought that was the key to opening the economy. It was so pushed so hard, so fast, Operation Warp Speed and all this stuff, that what happened is the vaccine companies who have manufactured a good product were in a position to really exaggerate the efficacy of the vaccine and not give good test results and didn't really level with the public, and neither did the CDC. They were promoting these vaccines as some sort of panacea, like measles or smallpox. But we're talking about a very different virus here than you get with smallpox. This is a virus that mutates. That's not a stable virus. And it's just not so simple to create a vaccine for it. What you're going to end up doing is a lot of hits and misses, like a lot like the flu vaccines, you know, and they only work a third of the time. So we were not told the truth about this, and the companies didn't tell the truth, and I understand why. Because they needed emergency use authorization, they ended up exaggerating the efficacy of their own product because they wanted to get it through, and everybody just wink, wink, nudge, nudge, and it went through. Well,
so
now
no liability.
And now we're finding out the truth about it, which is something, by the way, that every real vaccine expert in the field knew going into it. They knew that the best you could hope for from these vaccines is some slight minimization of severe effects,
and protecting of the people who otherwise would experience severe outcomes, which is overwhelmingly the very old and sick. Okay, so that they definitely needed to be vaccinated, and this vaccine really does give them an edge, you know, if they have a functioning immune system. And that is good enough. That's what we should have been telling the public. The truth has been a terrible casualty throughout this whole thing. We don't even believe what they say anymore. And for understandable reasons, we have been lied to consistently for 18 months, and people are just fed up with it, and the public health authorities are completely discredited.
Well, and one of the other things, too, another topic area in terms of the truth being a casualty is with respect to therapeutics. And the senior public health officials, the TV people, telling people to not believe their lying eyes or their own healthcare experience. I took ivermectin and I got better. No, that didn't happen. Or we're not allowed to talk about ivermectin. Yeah. And now you've got Cambridge researchers. This is interesting. It's even fascinating this is going on. Cambridge scientists using AI to uncover 200 approved drugs that have the potential to fight off COVID-19. They winnowed it down to two of the approved drugs, to already FDA approved, proguanil, an antimalarial drug, and sulfasalazine, a medication for rheumatoid arthritis and Crohn's disease, were able to suppress viral replication in cells, so that perhaps two more drugs already approved, full approval, could be repurposed. But you're not even allowed to have this discussion.
Well, this is one of the most bizarre aspects of the last 18 months. But, you know, just check your intuition on this. When there's a bug out there that gets people sick, what should you be thinking about? I think the first thing you should think about is how do we get sick people, how do we make sick people better?
Yes. That's just crazy enough to work, I think, that approach. It's just,
but instead, everybody's thinking about not about sick individuals and their doctors and what should be done to help sick people. Instead, we're thinking about these big macro, you know, public health issues. How do we suppress the virus? How do we drive it out nation by nation? How do we drive down the R-naught? All these big topics that had nothing to do with people's individual health. And so the therapeutics have been incredibly neglected. Not just neglected, but censored and demonized and dismissed. I mean, what is wrong with us?
I don't know.
What is?
Wait a second. Tell us what's wrong with us, Jeffrey.
You're supposed to tell us this. What is wrong with us? And Dan too.
Yeah. One other topic too, just because this is obviously front and center in the minds of anybody with school age children. Rochelle Walensky again on Brett Baer's program on Friday. Dr. Walensky, CDC director, giving the whole, like, as long as there's a virus in the community, then it's better if, you know, two-year-olds and up mask up in schools. And,
Jesus.
And you know, that they just and she will not get into specific data. She will not provide any context. She just does the appeal to, hey, the threat is out there, so let's err on the side of caution, right? Another phrase that's become meaningless through overuse and misapplication.
I get tired of it. You know, the articles about children and COVID have been pouring out from completely mainstream. The back in the day, it was only me and my friends were writing these things about this, that COVID was a vanishingly small threat to children at all. And that's a real blessing. Like, if you could choose COVID or Asian flu or polio, you would definitely choose COVID in terms of the demographic outcomes. This thing, it just has no effect on young people. And they're not the drivers of the disease. They're not spreaders of the disease. I mean, kids are kind of germ factories anyway, but COVID's the least of their problems. And that, you know, opinion, we were pushing out there in the spring of 2020. Now you see the same thing being pushed by The Atlantic, by The New Yorker.
Yeah.
There are articles in every kind of mainstream liberal, I hate to use that term because it's too flattering, every center-left publication saying the same thing, and still it's not having an effect. And I think this is because they're kind of caught on the horns of the limit, because they're saying all people who are unvaccinated need to be masked up and afraid. And, of course, the vaccines, you can't get the vaccine for children. So they're wanting to strap a piece of cloth on all the kids' faces and ruin their personalities. And I think it's perverse. And
I have to believe that something's going to give. And parents are furious about this. They should be. And there should be revolt. I think there is a growing revolt in this country. I don't believe, I can tell you that students in Texas, Florida, Georgia, South Carolina, South Dakota, Wyoming, and many other places will not be en masse this fall. They will not be. Now, I don't know about New York and Michigan and
Illinois
and California and so on. You know, increasingly compliance with these arbitrary edicts that make no sense is a political signal. It really is. Even in Texas, I have friends who said they went to church on Sunday. It was yesterday, and said that the known sort of center left members of the church were all in masks, and everybody else was not. So. We've got a political signal here. We've got a tribal identification sign going on, and it's truly tragic. It doesn't have to do with the public health anymore. It has to do with politics, and the political divisions of this country are going all the way down to the clothing choices that we wear on our faces. Unbelievable.
He is Jeffrey Tucker, editorial director for the American Institute for Economic Research, author of Liberty or Lockdown. Pick it up. Jeffrey, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate
it. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
And he joined us on the Turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.